If you asked me if I was middle class, I would say yes. I'm going to guess, without knowing the details of your personal situation, that most of you guys would probably say yes too. The middle class is a pretty elastic designation, honestly. There are a ton of different ways to define it. None of them is perfect. There are also a ton of ways to use it politically. As you may have noticed, if you've spent any time following Canadian politics in the past few years, the middle class is the main group all parties want to appeal to. So much so that us middle class folks now have our own member of the cabinet.
I, Mona Fortier, do solemnly and sincerely promise and declare that I will truly and faithfully, and to the best of my skill and knowledge, execute the powers and trusts reposed in me as Minister of Middle Class Prosperity and Associate Minister of Finance.
And even the minister responsible for prosperity among the middle class can't define who exactly belongs to it.
What is the middle class then?
Again, I'm back at saying middle class doesn't have a unique definition. We have to make sure we represent the realities in a rural, remote, or even urban setting.
Now, I'm still not sure what that minister is supposed to do that's not already covered by the ministers of finance and health and education and so forth. But I do know that creating that cabinet position is supposed to make me feel and you feel like the Trudeau government is looking out for people like us, the middle class. But to get back to where I started this, who are people like us? Who is really middle class? What does that term mean right now, in the year 2020, that it didn't when it was coined 70 years ago? Are the aspirations of the middle class of the 1950s really applicable to those of us who define ourselves as middle class right now? And what should the middle class of today be aspiring to, and what should that brand new minister who's responsible for our prosperity be doing to help us get there? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Max Fawcett is a writer, a reporter, and a commentator. He looked into the middle class of yesterday and today for The Walrus. Hello, Max.
Hey, Jordan, how are you?
I'm doing well. I need you to explain a little bit of history to me off the top. Where does our current notion and definition of the middle class come from? Like, how did we conceive of this and when?
I think it's emerged in the wake of the Second World War. You had soldiers demilitarizing. You had this massive workforce of women who had been participating in the military workforce. And it kind of combined to create this major economic boom throughout the Western world, where people bought houses, they bought cars, there was this ever-expanding array of consumer goods that they could put in their homes, and it really kind of combined to create this strong cultural image of a vibrant middle class. And to some extent, that's still the image that we have in our heads today.
What were the aspirations of the middle class back when it was conceived of? You know, what did those people strive for?
I think they strived for a lot of the things that the middle class today strives for, which is, you know, the best for their family, economic opportunity, the ability to enjoy life. But a lot of that was happening through the lens of consumerism. Consumerism was not nearly as much of a trend or an influence in the preceding, you know, call it half century of the 20th century. Certainly people consumed things, but consumption was not as much a driving force in the economy as it became in the years after the Second World War. So you had these families who were increasingly influential and powerful economically, and they demanded and purchased an increasing array of goods, whether it was dishwashers, stoves, cars, new clothes, you name it. It really became the way that the middle class expressed itself was through its consumer choices. And that built this new kind of economy. You know, we certainly were still manufacturing things in North America, but increasingly we were manufacturing things for middle class families. It wasn't just tanks and heavy machinery. It was household goods and appliances as well.
This is what I found fascinating about your piece and just the term in general, is it's this notion that was conceived of like 70 plus years ago that we're still aspiring to today, even though I would imagine the circumstances in which most people who would define themselves as middle class has changed pretty profoundly in that time.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we're as much a consumer culture as we've ever been. I'm thinking of the new earbuds or earphones that Apple just released that are apparently $700, and apparently people are lining up for them. So, you know, we may be in the middle of a pandemic, but we're still happy to consume and identify ourselves through our purchases. But the advantage that families had in the middle class families had back in the 50s, 60s, you know, in addition to not spending $700 on earphones, was a lot of them had a kind of built-in insurance policy in the fact that they were mostly one-income households. You know, we would never go back to that willingly, and certainly I wouldn't, where, you know, we had this division of labor where, you know, men worked and women took care of the home. But that did create a kind of insurance policy where if the man's job disappeared or he was out of work, the wife could go and take employment to sort of shore up the family's finances. And so they were just in a stronger economic position than the average middle class family is today, where by and large, it's both people working as hard as they can for as many hours as they can. And yet still we have, you know, these enormous mortgages on homes in major cities. A lot of us are carrying personal debt at levels that would have been inconceivable a generation ago. And so we appear to be doing well. We appear to be as middle class as our grandparents and parents were. And, you know, in many respects, we have better wine, better food, better appliances, better everything. But when you drill down to the sort of bedrock of our existence and how secure we feel compared to how secure they felt, I think we're not doing nearly as well. And that's kind of, I think that explains why a lot of middle-class people feel nervous these days. They feel, you know, precarious in ways that would have been, I think, kind of foreign to middle-class families in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
I don't generally love asking guests for numbers, but you mentioned a couple things about, you know, household debt and the overall financial security of the middle class then versus now. Can you give me some figures so I can understand just how much has changed?
Sure, happy to. So at the beginning of 2020, and this is before COVID and the government supports that have come in for COVID, kind of threw these numbers a little bit out of whack, but the average Canadian household owed $1.77 for every dollar of after-tax income, and combined, that's more than $2.3 trillion. Now, a lot of that is in our mortgages, in our homes, in our car payments, but that is a level of debt that would have been unfathomable to the middle class in the 1960s or in the 1970s. Back then, you know, the average household owed far less than a dollar for every dollar of after-tax income they had. And it's sort of a, if you look at the chart, it's like a ski hill. It just keeps going up and up and up, the amount of debt that we have. And part of that is a function of interest rates. You know, in the late 70s and early 80s, we had interest rates above 20% briefly, which is just, I mean, that's like, you know, the sky being red or the moon being made out of cheese. It just doesn't make any sense to us in 2020, but that's where it was. And, you know, and since then it's kind of been going down progressively to the point now where I think we've almost become accustomed to interest rates being at or near zero, which explains why we're so comfortable comparatively with taking out debt. But this is still a precarious position because interest rates can go up. And if they do, and certainly that's a possibility, it's going to put a lot of middle-class families in a real tough spot, tougher than they're in right now.
So is that level of debt sustainable in the long term for an entire, you know, middle class of people? How much of the middle class right now is living beyond its means?
I think that's one of those questions that we're only going to know the answer to in hindsight. So, you know, as a society, we have more debt on our balance sheet, both as households and as governments, than we've ever had before, and we just don't know where the line is in terms of how far we can go before we go too far. And, you know, you and I have talked about this, I think, in previous podcasts. So right now, Canadian households, as, you know, by and large, are okay. I put something in the piece from a poll that Ipsos did for the insolvency firm MNP that said almost a third of Canadians can't pay their bills without going deeper into debt, and another 21% said that they're $200 or less away from insolvency at the month's end. So that sounds bad. You know, I had some people on Twitter point out that being close to insolvency doesn't necessarily mean you're going to go into insolvency, but that kind of feels like missing the forest for the trees. The fact that a lot of people are that close, $200 or less is worrying. So if interest rates spiked up to 4 or 5% from where they are right now, I think that would put a lot of people in trouble, and it would require government to step in and do something to help them. And, governments have been pretty good about that over the last year, but even they have their limits. So I'm not sure that we can continue down this road of taking on ever more debt to finance ever more, and I don't want to say extravagant, but ever larger lifestyles. It's interesting. I've had this conversation with my parents, with other baby boomers, and have kind of pointed out that houses that cost $50,000 when they were my age now cost, $2.3 million. And their point was, well, our houses weren't the same as your houses are now. They weren't as big. They weren't as sort of well decorated, well taken care of. Their expectations, I think, were lower than what we've come to expect for ourselves as members of the middle class. And, that's, I think, a tribute to the success of marketing and the success of sort of, consumerism as a cultural force. But I'm not sure we can keep ratcheting up the levels here. I think we're kind of hitting a ceiling and kind of need to do a reassessment of just how important it is for us to have ever bigger homes, have ever newer cars, have ever more expensive vacations. I think it may be time to do a gut check there.
How do you go about doing that? Because that's what I'm really wondering about. We have a minister of the middle class now, so theoretically we're prepared to tackle the changing nature of this problem. But where do you even start when you have something that seems to begin kind of with just an aspirational mentality?
Yeah, the minister of middle class prosperity definitely was a thing and a title that came in for a lot of mockery, and I think much of it deserved. But underneath all of that, there was a really interesting kind of development that I don't think many people caught because, again, most of the attention was on the mockery. Mona Forche, who is said minister, was tasked with introducing the kinds of quality of life metrics that now Scotland and New Zealand use in their budgeting process to our own budgeting process. So, in addition to thinking about financial metrics, debt, deficits, all that kind of stuff, she's been charged with introducing health metrics. How does this budget reflect on the health of the population? How does it reflect on the mental health of the population, and so on? And I think that could prove to be transformative in the long run because it will shift the conversation around how we spend and how we invest to be sort of a bigger picture conversation. And I think, in our own lives, we need to do the same thing. So it's tricky to pull a silver lining out of COVID because there's been a lot of bad that it has brought to a lot of people. But I do think one of the silver linings is it's kind of forced us to reassess what really matters and the way that we spend our money. So from my perspective, and I'm a little sheepish about this, but I used to spend a fair bit of money on clothing. And I barely spent a nickel on it this year. I think I've gotten some new socks and maybe a shirt or two. And I'm just as happy as I was before about the clothes I put on my back. And I think a lot of people have experienced similar revelations about the fact that buying things doesn't actually make them any happier. What makes them happier right now is being able to see friends, being able to see family, and doing work that's important to them. So, maybe as we come out of this, we're going to be a little less willing to try to solve our happiness issues with money, and maybe we'll try to do it with relationships and with things that have deeper meaning. And if we do that, maybe the whole understanding of what it means to be middle class starts to change.
Have we maybe entered a phase where just based on the numbers behind it, not as many people are middle class as think they are middle class based on what they can afford and how we define it. I mean, I played a clip in the intro to this episode in which our Minister of Middle Class Prosperity could not really accurately define what middle class was. And it feels like there really is no definition, and most people would consider themselves that, even though it's almost impossible for young people to own a home, even though we're carrying higher and higher levels of debt. Like, at what point do we say, like, that's not middle class?
Yeah, that's the idea of what is and isn't middle class and where the sort of demarcation lines are on it is an interesting question. I mean, you know, you can do it with percentage of household income. You can do it with percentage of you know, assets owned in a household. You can do it a lot of ways with metrics. But the funny thing is you'll still always see, you know, people who make $500,000 a year consider themselves middle class. And by the same token, you'll see, you know, students just out of university who barely make $25,000 think they're middle class. So, you know, I think middle class is more of a mindset than a metric. And it's fair to criticize the minister for not being willing or able to put hard definitions around it. But I think that reflects the fact that none of us can really do it. It's more of an aspirational thing. And on some level, that is one of the valuable aspects of the idea of middle class, is that it's one of the last places where we all kind of feel like we belong to a certain extent. You know, we're all increasingly polarized by, you know, partisanship and things we believe and ways we are online. And it feels like it's harder and harder to find common ground with other people. But at least for now, it seems like there's a lot of middle ground on the idea that we're all middle class or would like to become middle class. And I think that has value, and we should try to work with that.
What concrete steps could government take to enable this shift from a commercial-based middle class to a sustainable and health-based one?
First and foremost, the government has the power to tax, and it has used that power in recent years in very different ways than it did when the middle class was at its strongest. So, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, the top marginal tax rate was 80%. You know, that's unfathomable in this day and age. You know, in some cases, you know, people in the wealthiest 1% pay less in taxes in terms of their rate than you know, teachers and bus drivers. So I think we need to fix that. I'm not saying that all the answers lie in just taxing the rich, but we certainly can tax the rich more. We've lost sight of the fact that taxes are not just money that goes out. They are the price of society and of the kind of society we want. And I think if we want to rebuild the middle class and help make it stronger, we need to be willing to pay the price. But it's also about investing in places and things that makes consumerism perhaps a little less relevant in terms of how we create our own identities. So, you know, for the last 30 years, the federal government has been kind of all in on promoting home ownership as a way to build wealth. And, you know, in some respects, it's been very successful there. But that's not going to work for younger Canadians unless they have, you know, parents who are wealthy and willing to help them out. You know, when you look at Toronto and Vancouver, the housing markets there are basically unapproachable for young people, young members of the middle class. So the government can certainly support other forms of housing, whether it's cooperative housing, you know, lower cost rental housing, multi-generational housing. There's lots of ways they can expand the playing field there. They can certainly do more to support families by supporting, you know, a federal daycare standard. You know, we've been talking about this, it seems like, for my entire life, but we haven't done anything about it yet. If we made major investments in childcare, the degree to which it would empower not just women, but you know, middle class families across the country, I think would be astonishing. It would create space for them. It would create a sense of security and would allow them to make different choices than they do right now. So there's lots that government can do if it summons the courage. And you know, I hate to be a broken record, but it feels like the last 10 months, 12 months have shown that governments can do a lot more than we thought they could going into COVID. And I think it's up to all of us to hold them accountable to that, that they can't go back to the way things used to be of saying, well, we can't afford that. Well, you know, it's too ambitious. It's not too ambitious. They can be ambitious. It's just whether they want to do it or not. But it's also up to us, you know. We can't just expect the government to fix this for us. We have to be accountable for our own choices and accountable for the fact that buying more stuff does not make us happier. What makes us happier are our relationships, our having jobs that we love, you know, all these sort of non-financial or non-consumer things. And we got to be willing to put the HGTV crack pipe down and kind of, you know, be a little more invested in the communities we create rather than just trying to buy our way to happiness.
That was going to be my last question anyway. So I'm glad you brought it up because I just don't know how feasible it is to imagine that happening across the entire swath of Canada that we consider the middle class. Consumerism is entrenched in our daily lives. And, you know, I don't want to sound like an idealistic hippie when I say maybe we should all, you know, learn to practice mindfulness or meditate or value time with family and friends. But, I mean, I don't know how you get Canadians to shift that mindset en masse.
I would have agreed with you wholeheartedly before COVID. I think it would have, you know, absent some sort of major shock to the system, I don't really see how we could have gotten off of this you know, escalator that we've been on our whole lives. It's too entrenched in our economy. It's too entrenched in our culture, and it's too entrenched in our own kind of lived experiences. It's in our bones to want to buy things, right? And it's how we identify ourselves. It's how we express our individuality, which, you know, don't even get me started about that. But it really is just, it's bedrock stuff. But again, you know, the last year with COVID has really shaken some things loose. It's given us an opportunity, and God help me, I'm going to use this phrase. It's given us an opportunity to reset a lot of the things in our lives. And you know, I don't think that we need to be conspiracy minded about the idea of a reset. I think we needed one. We were doing things and behaving in ways that were, you know, not just destructive to the planet, not just destructive to our communities, but were destructive to ourselves. We were not getting any happier by buying more things. You know, like the data here is very clear that you know, people were not getting happier because they had bigger homes or because they had done a renovation recently that was inspired by, you know, a show they saw on HGTV. And I apologize for double tapping HGTV here, but you know, this has given us a chance to reevaluate, and it's up to us. Do we want to do it? I think you're right. I think it's entirely possible that we could go back to the way things were once the vaccine's out there. And you know, there is this incredible longing for things to go back to normal. But I do think that we should take the next, you know, 5 or 6 months before we all get the poke in the arm and just ask ourselves, do we really want to go back to the way things were? Do we, you know, is that really what we want? Or do we want to build a new normal? And we do have that opportunity.
See, I've just spent the last half hour talking with you about this, and I'm very intentional about it, but I also really want a PS5, Max.
Look, nobody's perfect. I think we're all allowed to have a few, you know, consumer impulses. Lord knows I'm probably going to buy some clothes when this thing is all over, but you know, just little steps, little directional turns towards a different way of creating a middle class, I think, will matter in the long run. And you know, governments can help us get there. I do believe that.
Thanks for taking the time to talk about this today.
Happy to. Thanks for your interest in my story.
Max Fawcett is a writer and reporter and commentator, and he wrote about the middle class for The Walrus. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca, hit us up on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Tell us if you think you're not middle class, unless you're rich, in which case I don't want to hear from you. You can also find us in your podcast player, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever. Doesn't matter. When you find us, leave us a rating, leave us a review. If you like us, tell your friends, spread the word. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.